Hey Alex McWilliam, how you doing? You all right?
I'm good, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm very good. As you know, I'm living in a B&B in Oxford this week. Last night at 11:15, I was locked out of my room in just a towel. So I was doing improv last night.
Always, just a little bit of freestyle, just have a bit of fun.
Yeah, no, it's cool. Mate, look, I appreciate you coming on, and it's obviously it's an area that's really interesting for me because I actually think this is like. Well, it's options, isn't it? So as a coach or a leader, it's options and decision making, and it is essentially improv sometimes. So that's what we're going to explore with no plan whatsoever. So that makes it even better. Do you want to explain briefly, like what's got you to this point and the fact that you are?
So I trained as an actor. I went to Guildford School of Acting 2008 to 2011, and then I still am acting. I sort of performed in a variety of sort of theatre, a bit of film, a bit of TV, and quite a few commercials. That's kind of where I really loved sort of auditioning. And there was a lot of improvisation in commercials because they would give you the script and they'll say, right, in this scene, I would like you to do this, react in this way, and react like that, and you get one take, and that's your audition. You're in there for less than sort of 3 minutes sometimes, and then your fate is decided. And I really enjoyed that, and I've always enjoyed watching improvisation. So whose line is it anyway? I'm sorry, I haven't a clue. All of those kind of things. And around 10 years ago, I wanted to set up my own improvisation troupe. Because I love playing those games and I wanted to just have fun basically in an evening and not have to worry about learning lines, which is ironic as an actor. I kind of enjoy not having to prep anything at times, even though there is some prep to a degree of what games we're going to play. And so we started doing shows regularly and I started taking classes regularly with my friend and mentor, a guy called Seamus Allen, who is a brilliant improviser and a brilliant teacher. And after that, after kind of a few years of that, and around, I'd say around 5 years ago, I started noticing that there was a gap potentially in the corporate market. And I could see how using these improvisational games and exercises could help people to become more creative, better team members, better presenters, and become more confident. Because the improv classes that I was taking part in had actors and non-actors, and the non-actors were from all sorts of fields, from sciences, from IT, from sales, from every avenue, really. And so I started Improv for Business, which is the kind of coaching and training company. And we worked mainly on kind of how to use improv to build a bit of creativity and team building. And then a couple of years ago, we actually went, actually, let's focus in on one thing. And that's presentation skills and presentation training. So, how can I make people not feel with dread when they're standing up on stage? As often people are terrified of speaking in front of other people, either their peers, their friends, their families. You know, is it the best man speech, the maid of honor speech? Is it kind of that presentation at work that they get absolutely terrified of? And I thought, well, improv can help because I know myself. I get a little bit anxious sometimes when performing, and I know that improvisation has helped me kind of become more confident and more articulate when I'm speaking. So I went through that and I sort of started exploring how to use improvisation. I had some lovely clients, and I still have some amazing clients that I work with. And then I thought, well, there must be some psychology behind this. So pre kind of pandemic, sort of just before the pandemic started, I thought, let's do a master's in psychology, as you do, just casually, as you do. And so I studied years. I wanted to find a master's that I could do at home, that I didn't have to go anywhere for. I could do lots of self-study and I could do it in a very efficient time. So around 11 months later, I finished my master's in psychology with BPP University, which was a really nice university to work with because it was all self-study. There was a few lectures, but I could work a lot on my own, which I found quite useful. And then my friend and mentor, Seamus, was doing a performance psychology. He's just started, actually, he's in his third year now, his performance psychology master's at Bangor University. And that was really interesting. I was like, oh, why, you know, how do people in teams, in sport and business thrive as performers? And so I contacted them and said, hello, could I do a PhD in, I've got an idea of using improv to help people become more confident and less anxious when presenting. And they were interested in that idea. And fast forward to my third year, where I am now, and it's been a whirlwind of a year, and I'm still doing lots of stats and stuff. However, I'm working on how improvisation can reduce the anxiety related to performance, in mainly in presentations, but also in other settings. And because actually, I'm probably the least straight psychologist doing my PhD, because my school is actually the sports psychology department, but I'm doing a very psychology-based PhD, but I'm using loads of sports psychology in it because it's all about performance related, which I found really fascinating. And that's where we are today, sort of from the humble beginnings up to where I am mid-PhD, teaching and training people in presentation skills and becoming more confident as they speak and present.
So soon to be Dr. Alex McWilliam.
Hopefully, yes.
Change the name on your Zoom. A few things. I've got lots of like threads to unpick. One is, well done, you have a great actor's voice.
Oh, thank you.
I wouldn't be a very good actor. People often go,
oh, you would?
I would be mumbling. Second thing is, like, I was speaking to a leader yesterday in business, and he said, I said, would you have many karaoke moments? Like, for me, a karaoke moment is, I would sing, but like I wouldn't feel that good about it. I'd be quite nervous. It wouldn't be debilitating. And he said, interestingly, I had one the other day, and there was a lady that was presenting with me, and I could see she was really nervous. And she was like going through all the stuff, you know, and she said, and I said, oh, you okay? And she said, no, I'm really nervous. And he said, oh, you'll be fine. And he said, it probably wasn't the best thing to say, but I guess it's like, it's quite a big thing for people, isn't it? So either as, you know, as a coach, like standing and presenting in front of a group outside, or doing some presentation stuff inside, or as a leader where you've got to present to a client or got to show up. Those, I guess, there'd be a lot of people that would find this quite a challenging thing to do.
Yeah. So improvisation, naturally, you go, oh my God, this is going to be terrifying. I've got to perform. I've got to be an actor, performer. However, the conversation we're having right now is improvisation. And every single conversation you have with every friend, family, peer, mentor, colleague is improvised. You could script it, and I'm sure some people do. They script, I'm going to say this to my boss, I'm going to say this to my colleague, but your colleague doesn't have the same script. So as soon as you start speaking, your script goes out of the window and you're going to have to improvise. And it is, I think, it can be scary. And what I find really I find it really fulfilling when teaching and coaching is I take someone who's terribly anxious about speaking to a group, and by the end of a session or the end of a course of sessions, they're so much more confident and they're having fun at the same time. Because I know the amount of training I've seen or been in that is horrifically boring and it's so tedious, and someone just stands at the front and goes, hello, everyone, this is how you present and this is how you become better and more confident. But actually, you need to have that exposure and that practice. And I treat it exactly like a sport. A presentation, I would class, is just the same as a performance, because you're going to have to demonstrate a skill in front of other people and you're going to have to do it under pressure. The same thing as a rugby, a football match, a basketball match. You're going to practice all the time. However, when you're in that championship game where there's 20,000 people, a million people watching you, you're going to have to perform under pressure. And if you can't do it, or you fail to perform under pressure, usually there is an anxiety impairing that performance. And it could be something that could be easily overcome, or it could be something that is a little bit more in depth. But a lot of people just don't practice.
That's the main thing. Like, it's the same with coaching, really. Like, even I remember doing a hockey course once and looked over, and there's a lady who's about to do the next thing, and she was like walking through the area, having like fictional conversations with people. And I was like, you're like, what are you up to? She said, oh, I work in sales, we practice all the time. And I thought, most coaches don't practice all the time, quite frankly. And the other thing is, I guess they probably don't get as much feedback as would be helpful for them as well. So when you started talking about this, my immediate thought was like, well, there's two strands I want to go down. One was, you said, oh, Seamus is a brilliant improviser. And I thought, okay, what skills does he have? And then the next thing is, so like, what's the end in mind? What are the skills you develop? And then I thought, okay, how would I coach this? So I'm thinking games-based, like having a go, the appropriate level, but with little things like hidden like vegetables that they don't realise because we don't want them to get anxious about it. But suddenly they've done it and they go, oh, right, I just did that and I didn't realise I could do it. Am I on the right track?
Yeah, so I think some of the time, like especially with the improv, it can be a bit like, oh my God, this is daunting, or I'm overthinking it. I'm in that kind of analytical mind of I'm work mode and I'm not in play mode. And with the improvisation, a key aspect of it, we got to warm everyone up and relax them into the room. That's the first thing. And then rather than going in full hog and kind of going, I'm going to make you present straight away, because that's going to be when people run out of the room and terrified, you slowly build up their comfort zone, slowly expanding it. You do a bit of low focus pair exercises where they go, right, we're going to do this. You're presenting to one person. Great. You're enjoying that. You're having fun. But also we're coping with the potential things that you're worried about. So generally, a lot of people are worried about people judging them negatively and people kind of just reacting negatively. That's probably the main reaction. So they go, I worry that people aren't going to like me. I'm worried that I'm going to fail in front of other people. That's probably a common one that people go, that's what I'm scared of most. Or I'm terrified of presenting in front of Terry because Terry's a big boss and I feel so worried when he's watching me. So what we do is we build up that comfort zone and I make sure everyone works with a different person. Because a lot of the time in these workshops, some people, or in previous ones I've seen, people would work with the same person throughout the whole day or the whole half day and they never interact. But I encourage everyone to go, right, switch partners, change again, new person, new person, new person. Because a lot of the time, some of the worries or anxieties you have against or towards someone else is because you don't really know them. They might be a new person. You don't really speak to them much in the office. You don't really know their name potentially sometimes. But doing the amount of pair work, what that allows is for you to kind of break down those misconceptions and barriers and go, oh, you're not as scary as I thought. And then you build that up group by group and go, right, we're now performing groups of 3, 4, 5, but also doing it in a fun way. So there's a great exercise I love doing, which we have 5 or 6 people standing up in front of a line. And this happens sort of halfway through a workshop sometimes. And they'll tell a story and I'll point to them and I'll say, right, okay, you start off. And when I point to the next person, they carry on exactly from where the previous person left off. If you make a mistake though, I'm going to shout die in your face. You're going to have to apologize for ruining my story. I'm going to give you a clap and you're going to be out of the game. And if they get really good at it, I put a limitation on it, which means they're going to have to fail. Because it's almost impossible to do it without when you have that limitation in place. So they get used to someone shouting die in their face, which is never going to happen in the business world. Well, you hope not in the business world.
Apparently Terry does do that.
I mean, to be honest, there are some people who've said, I said, oh, no one ever says no to your face. And they go, actually, yeah, my boss says no constantly to my face.
I guess, it's interesting, isn't it, that you go like, yeah, I guess you're trying to get people to die on stage. And I somehow chatted to Claire Murphy around this. And one of the first, not first, but they want people to experience that to go, this is as bad as it gets. Now, I think what you're saying is, like, some people do go, this is as bad as it gets. This has happened, some of this stuff.
And I think it's kind of going through that kind of to die on stage is really important. But also what's really important is to give you that exposure to whatever you are worried about. And that's traditional in sort of psychotherapies where you go, well, what are you afraid of? Well, I'm afraid of this thing. Great. Well, if I throw you in the deep end, it's going to be too much. Jordan Peterson does a great analogy of if you're scared of like going in an elevator, we'll look at an elevator first. Great. Okay. Can you handle that? Great. Now we're going to get into an elevator for 2 seconds and then jump out. It's the same thing with presenting. If you are terrified of it, and your boss makes you present in front of 500 people within the first 2 weeks of you working there, you are going to have a horrific experience and never want to present again. But what you need to do is go, right, I'm going to present to one of you. Now I'm going to present to 2, to 5, to 10, to 20, to 100. But also not only the audience, the duration. I'm going to present for one word. Can I master that? Great. Now I'm going to do a sentence. Now I'm going to do a paragraph. Now I'm going to do 2 minutes. And what that does is it might feel slow and tedious, but actually, until you get to a point where you can master that and feel so comfortable that there's no negative emotional reaction, then actually that's the step you need to go. And it might take you years and years to get there. However, you're going to master each experience as it goes, and you're going to thrive, as opposed to having a terrifying experience that then makes you avoid every opportunity. Because I know if you asked any of your colleagues or anyone in a business setting, if you had the opportunity not to present, would you avoid it? And a lot of people go, yeah, I don't want the pressure or the stress. But what you want is, if you can have people going, yes, I would love to, because there are so many people in the business world, in schools and in educations, who have amazing ideas. They have ideas that can change the world. You know, is it the new Apple? You know, is it the new whatever technology, whatever it might be? But if they're too afraid to speak and share it, the idea gets lost and we lose it forever. But if we can get them confident and comfortable by going, yes, I've got this amazing idea, I want to share it, then actually our world can change for the better. I think that's the essence of it. And that's why it's so important to be able to present and speak in front of other people.
Yeah, there'd be a lot of, for me, like people who are sat in, not even in big meetings, like four or five people, you know, highly introverted, a bit worried about like how they might be judged. And again, I think there's another element around about the leadership and the environment, isn't there, to make sure that we give opportunities for people to do that. The levels make sense to me. Confidence needs evidence, is what Walshy says. Like, I would be very surprised if you asked anyone, like, have they, you know, you'd almost go like, okay, we want to get to this point, design 11 levels for the day and co-create it with me and let's work out what it is for you. Because it'd be different for different people, different. Some people go, oh, that leap was a bit like hard for me. And other people go, oh, that leap was okay. But again, if you ask them, none of them will be doing any of that stuff in their normal words. And exactly the same in sport, quite frankly. Like, there wouldn't be, that just doesn't exist. Like, people don't practice that stuff. Like, not as, I guess, as deliberately and intentionally as they could. Because I assume also, like, you're getting feedback from their peers. So you're going, come on, like, give Alex a shout out. What was the stuff that he did was he thought was the most impactful there? Or actually, like, how did he make you feel when he did that? So
and it's really important. So after every exercise and every exercise we do, I will get to the group and go, how does it make you feel? What did you observe? How can you relate this exercise that's nothing to do with work to your work life? Right. Oh, this exercise. Well, actually, this exercise helps to reduce our ambiguity in our speech. This helps get us used to having to change our ideas and have to improvise when a client goes, oh, we can't afford that. I'm used to having to adapt and change. And I think practice is a really important thing, because at the beginning of each session, I will say, how does everyone feel about presenting? You know, if we're doing a presentation training. And then I'll ask a question going, how much do you practice? Say you've got a presentation in 2 weeks. Put your hand up if you practice more than an hour. Most of them will not put their hand up. And I'll say, less than half an hour? Less than 10 minutes? Less than 5 minutes? You don't practice? You know, there's this definite scale going down. And a lot of it is because they have other tasks. And there's a great quote I remember saying, no one's ever too busy. It's always about priorities. If you want to do something, you'll make the time. If I want to go to the gym, I will make the time to go to the gym. If I want to do this, I will make the time to do it. And I think that's really important. But a lot of the people either don't value it as an important skill, or it's that ironic situation of, I don't want to practice, because when I practice, it reminds me that I'm not any good. And that makes me feel really bad. And I really don't like that feeling. So I avoid practicing. But weirdly, it's that kind of, you have to do it. It's a similar process of, it's worth investigating whether those people with sports injuries, what's the attrition rate regarding their physio appointments? Because every time they go to physio, they're reminded that their knee's busted and they're not going to play for ages. And so actually that has a negative psychological effect on them, because they go, oh God, I feel really rubbish every time I go. I know I need to go, but I feel bad every time I go because I'm not in my prime. I'm not in my prime fitness. And it's the same with presentations. So I've always encouraged people to go, right, you can find half an hour a week to practice your presentation skills, especially if it's an important one, especially if that pitch is going to worth £10 million to your company. You've got to practice.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because it's like high performance moment. Like, you know, Johnny Wilkinson definitely practiced drop goals.
But it's also going back from a psychological point of view. there's so many different skills regarding presentations. There's voice, there's body, there's articulation, there's modulation, there's pitch range, there's projection. All of these technical skills that everyone has to think about. However, if you can get them to be autonomous, then actually it means that you can focus on the words, or you can actually still have that anxiety or worry inside your head, but it's not going to impact performance. Like a lot of high performing athletes will have automatic movements. Like if I said to you, like a great example there's a reinvestment theory in psychology, which we sort of, when we're learning a skill, we things become automatic. However, if we overthink things, we go back to a basic level of learning and it gets a bit clunky. Like if we were playing golf and I said, oh my God, you've got a great swing there. What were you doing with your arms to get such a good swing? You'll start to think about that and then you might miss your next shot because you're overthinking it. So that's a way, if you're ever playing mini golf with someone and they're beating you, just ask them. Pardon?
It's a good way of winning.
Well, it's a good way, but also it highlights the point of going, well, actually, if you overthink something that becomes automatic, then actually it goes all over the place. It's like when people say, what do I do with my hands? Ah, what do I do with my hands when I'm speaking? Go, what do you do when you're speaking to your friends? Oh, I don't think about it. Exactly. Don't think about it. And naturally, you will start to articulate and gesture with your body. But when we get on stage, we go, ah, I should be moving my hands at this point now, and I don't know how to move my body. I've lost how to move as a human. And it's that weird effect of just don't overthink it. It's it reminds me of have you seen the Last Samurai? Have you not seen? Oh, it's a great film. I really enjoy it. But there's a bit where they're like, just don't. You've got too many things in your head. Just don't overthink. Just be with it. And that just highlights the same thing of just, if you don't overthink things, then it allows you to be in the moment and perform.
Yeah, I was thinking about that because, again, as you know, your challenge, obviously, in this situation is to, like, is to develop people's awareness. But again, like, there's lots of things to develop awareness of. You're probably going, what's the most important? What's the limiting factor? let's focus on that, as opposed to, like, lots of other things. And then I start to think, like, do people have a video themselves? Do they, like, because then suddenly, like, we have this... I think that's probably even more stressful than me presenting to other people, is the thought of me, like, watching myself present, like, to just with no one in the room, quite frankly.
So it goes back to when we, for example, we have videoed people because it's really useful to see. However, if I show the video straight away and I make you watch it straight away, you go, ah, there's too much of things I need to look at it. So great technique is going, right, we videoed it. Right, we're going to not show the video. We're going to listen to it. So then I can just focus solely on that auditory element or the visual element. And then we flip it around to go, right, I'm going to watch it, but mute it. But one thing I've really instilled in my workshops and when coaching is go, right, we're getting rid of the term good and bad. Good and bad isn't a great way of giving feedback because it hurt. Either I feel really good because I get, oh, great. Oh, I feel really good. Good feedback. Or I get some bad feedback and I feel really sad or really resentful or whatever. So what I suggest is you go, let's change the words to effective and ineffective. Right. Your voice was effective because you had clear pronunciation, good effective articulation, and a well-modulated voice. Your physicality was ineffective because you were fidgeting. Because what that does now is I get an objective mindset of going, I know what I need to fix, and there's no personal kind of attack on you by saying it's good or bad. And that, I think, is a really important thing because it takes away the person from the technical skill. Going, right, your gestures were ineffective because you were stuck to your waist at the same time. So it didn't really articulate everything. Or your content was ineffective because there was no clear structure. Great. I now know, as a performer, I need to work on my structure. I now know, as a coach, the main aim is to go on is to work on that structure. And yes, there are going to be lots of things that someone might have. They might need to work on this, 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 and this. And so we take one thing at a time because throwing in everything at the same time is too much. Go, right, this week, we're going to work on your pitch range. So during the week, I want you to do this away from me. Next week, because weirdly or quite nicely, sometimes you fix one problem, everything else gets solved. And you go, great, that solves a lot of problems, because sometimes it's just that one little thing. It's like the one thing's wrong with your car and actually everything else works nicely because it was just a little problem you were having there.
More threads I've unpicked. One is, well, I actually played around with your video and your audio thing and it was really helpful. So thank you.
That's all right.
Second thing, I was then trying to go, what are your big rocks? Is it like voice, physicality, content? Am I missing anything else there?
So I think, yeah, you've got a voice, you've got your body, and then you've also got the content. And there is other technical skills that we sort of train, but less of improvisation about how to make it memorable, but also how to use visuals. Because again, the amount of death by PowerPoint that I'm sure you've seen. And it's because people aren't confident in the material.
Yeah, 100%. It's 100%. I've worked with a coach who, and I won't mention the coach who, this would be like his worst nightmare. So he put every single word on one slide and it was like 3,000. It looked like 3,000 words. And like he just like held it up, and then one of the people in the room said, and everything was like contingent upon the first line. And someone in the room said, I disagree with the first line. And I could see him physically start sweating. It was definitely interesting. And then I thought, who's doing this really well? And then like I started to go, this is like coaching. This is like teaching. Like you never complete it, do you? Like, so I thought of Obama. So when Barack Obama does his fired up, ready to go speech, like, I think that's as good as I've seen. But I guess, who are the people that, like, if you were to go, oh, go and watch these people, they're doing great stuff. And then also, like, what are their skills? So what is it that, like, separates them?
Yeah, so I think some of the things I've noticed is there's no one unanimous way. Here's how to present effectively. There's no one way of presenting.
Because the other thing, sorry, while you were speaking, was like, there's no point me trying to be like Obama, is there? Like, because I'm not him. And if I try to go, fired up, ready to go, people go, rest of your mental.
But that's it. Because you can look at people and go, they're really effective. And I'll give some examples of people. But you've got to find out what is your style of presenting. Like, I know I'm quite animated when I'm presenting and when I'm coaching, because I don't know why. I think I've just ended up being quite an animated person. I'm naturally quite an introverted person when I'm, especially in certain situations. I'll tell you, on a little side tangent, I went to see Mother Goose a couple of weeks ago with my girlfriend for my birthday, and it's got Ian McKellen and John Bishop. And at the stage door, I was like trying to get a photo, and I was like, I was so shy. I was like, and we missed it. We didn't get a shot opportunity. I was like, no, it's fine, it's fine. And my girlfriend Amy was like, no, no, it's fine. I was like, no, no, it's fine, it's fine. Like a 4-year-old child going, no, no, don't do it. And so we were walking back. I was like, oh, it's fine, it's fine. And in the distance, in Westgate Shopping Mall in Oxford, I go, I think that's Sir Ian McKellen. And Amy went, oh, let's get a photo. I was like, no, 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 please don't bother them. Please don't bother them. And so she ran up to them and went, it's my boyfriend's birthday. He's your biggest fan. Can I have a photo? And I was like, hi, thank you. And then I said I was an actor. And then their faces changed. They go, great, he's not like one of those crazy people who's just sort of stalking us. And we had a nice conversation. And it was just so interesting how that completely changed, like, my, oh, please, oh, no, don't make me do it, please. But going back to sort of presenting styles, there's a great presenter. It was the late Sir Ken Robinson. Is one of my, I love his presentations because he instills such great storytelling and humor into his presentations that it's a joy to watch. If anyone gets the opportunity, watch Sir Ken Robinson do Schools Kill Creativity. Is a purely like magical TED talk. I really love that. But I think, generally speaking, the ones who seem authentic themselves, so they're not trying to put on a persona, like I've been told to articulate and gesture. And I think it's people who tell a great story and don't overcomplicate things by chucking in too much technical language and jargon that just alienates your audience. I've seen so many presentations, and I think this is where visuals really hinder. So many, especially in university and educational settings, where you've got so many, like basically, a good rule of thumb is, if I can understand your slide without you needing to be there, you don't need to be there at all. Send me a PDF and save me the half an hour. Because a way of framing it is, while your presentation might take an hour, and that's an hour of your time, if you've got 500 people watching it, that's 500 hours. So in a business, your presentation better be worth 500 hours worth of content for people to watch. I think that's really important. I think being a good storyteller, knowing who your audience is, because that's a big one. A lot of people just have a generic presentation. They don't look at the audience. However, if your presentation is full of technical language and it's geared towards a technical audience, great. If it's geared towards novices, not great. Same thing with coaching. If you're coaching, say, novices in the field of, like, you know, let's do jiu-jitsu. I've never done jiu-jitsu, but we'll use it.
The way you went straight into, like, the most random sport ever. I love it.
It's because I saw a random video earlier about jiu-jitsu, so it's probably on the mind. But if you started with, like, oh, jiu-jitsu, right, we're going to learn all this technical language of this, and this, go, oh, it's too much. Give me the basics first and then build up. So Sir Ken Robinson, I really love him as a presenter.
I'm with you on Sir Ken, by the way, and every school goes, it's just not true. And I'm thinking, you probably need to watch it properly.
I'm also
reading this book, The Science of Storytelling.
Oh, nice.
Being an existential crisis. Because essentially what it starts with is the stuff you're talking about with authenticity is like, who am I? Like, that's our quest on this planet, isn't it? To work out who we are without getting too deep about this. And then the other thing you triggered me on was like, just people being able to see your language is so important. And I see it in loads of coaching where, you know, you'll say to the kids afterwards, do you know what a breakdown is? And they'll go, is it like when the car stops working? Okay. And we're just not tuned into their language, really.
And it is about learning. So when I'm sort of coaching people in presentations, I go, right, who's the audience? And they go, I haven't thought about that. Well, how can you create a presentation if you don't know who you're talking to? Oh, okay, I'm talking to execs. Okay, what are they like? Oh, it's like this. Or how much they know about your product already? Oh, they know everything. Great, you don't need to do the origin story. You just need to talk about an update. Or they don't know anything about it. Great, we need to go to the beginning. And it was interesting. So I had one client who was, they were doing a fun thing at work where they were kind of pitching for kind of like a Dragon's Den kind of money thing for like a charity thing. So it was a nice thing to do at their business. And he gave me his pitch. I was like, okay, it's really technical. I'm not really emotively connected. Tell me a story. Why is this charity so important to you? And he goes, oh, well, my mother, you know, and he sort of spoke on a story about that. And, well, why didn't you talk about that? Why don't you start with that? And then he did his presentation again. And he went, oh, yeah. And he started, and we reframed it. We worked through it. And he went, oh, yeah, so 5 years ago, my mother did this and I was struggling with this and she found this, you know, this charity and they really changed her life. And I was like, that's just basic for a story. And we shaped that and we worked through it and we played around with it. And then he won. And it won because people connected to that audience, that kind of emotive connection, because we appealed to that. We connected with that. And that was really great for him to see and for him to enjoy and go, ah, it's not what I'm used to presenting. Because in the corporate world, they're stuck in, a lot of the time, people are stuck in their ways of going, this is how it's been done for 50 years, and this is how it should be done. But actually, it's not the most effective way of doing it. And we can do these little tweaks, and already you're improving your presentation skills, your slides, your story, your content, and it's already so much better. And you feel more confident, because you go, oh, great. I don't feel terrified because I feel actually quite, and I think there's, so in my research, there's a difference between the term confidence and self-efficacy. So the confidence is, I can be confident in anything. I can be confident that I'm going to fail. I can be confident that I'm going to win. Whereas the self-efficacy of I believe or I have the ability that I can achieve what I want to achieve is a very basic way of saying it. And I think that's a way of framing it. And confidence is a nice way of saying it to laypersons. Like if you're coaching someone, say, how confident are you? Don't use the word self-efficacy because they're going to be like, what is that? So I trained, again, we're going on tangents. I trained as a personal trainer years ago. So technically, I'm a fully qualified personal trainer as well. And I remember learned...
Are you ever combining the two?
So I have, when I've been coaching, when I've been teaching acting and improvisation, one of the classes I have taught is like body conditioning for actors, because you have to be physically fit for acting, like all the physical roles you might play and the stamina to be a performer. And also presenting, you've got to be physically fit to a degree, because if you're presenting, like, you're going to sweat, you're going to have endurance, especially if you're presenting for an hour, your voice is going to get tired. And if you don't use it effectively, you're going to kind of get that, you're going to sort of feel tired, you're going to feel really sore at the end of it, or your voice will go. If you're, especially if you're doing like a tour of talks, say you're an executive in a corporation, and you need to go to every office and do a presentation for the next 6 months or whatever, talking to the staff about changes. If you don't have the stamina, your voice is going to sort of go by the end of it. And you'll be like, hello, welcome to what I'm talking about today. It's sort of going to go at the end of it, I think.
Yeah, no, I wrote a few things down. I was at a place the other day. And again, I should be getting a percentage on this book, but it talks about like it's starting almost with a change or a surprise. And I got introduced to a girl, and she said to me, the first thing she said to me, oh, really nice to meet you, Rusty. No one in my family thought I'd make it to this age. I was like, okay, wow, right. This is interesting, isn't it? Like, I need to, it's something that definitely inspires curiosity. And like, yeah, wow. And then the other thing it made me think about is like, how, and again, with coaches or leaders, often when we're just around our same team, we can get comfortable in that environment. But actually those karaoke moments of stretching ourselves in the same way you said about like mixing up the groups, trying different things, playing different games, like is different for different people, isn't it? So that extra stimulus or that new information is vital so that we can become, I guess, you want skillful, adaptable improvisers. And then it then got me thinking to like, so something I'm really interested in sport is like what do people think planning is? So I guess you said at the start, like, what did you say? You said some prep. So I was like, okay, what does he mean by some prep? And again, maybe another question to think about is that, has that changed over time for you? Because again, yeah, it's changed massively for me. But I'm just curious as to like, if you can remember back that far, to the, you know, the post personal trainer days to the present day, like what's planning been to you over those times?
Yeah, so there's two, I suppose there's two different avenues from a performance point of view and then from a coaching point of view. The performance point of view, when I said earlier, would have been related to, we prep as much as we know the games we're playing and we develop the skills of improvisation. That's kind of a, I would say, from a slightly different, but from coaching point of view, I'll always have a plan of going, right, these are the, well, original plan of these are the exercises we're going to do. And I, from experience, I kind of know what exercises work really well with the group and also which ones they react well to. Because again, the corporate world, a lot of them aren't actors. And as soon as there's going to be a slightly higher resistance to anything where you go, you've got to be a character or you've got to be a performer. So I've learned that. And I took a lot of time to learn. Actually, they don't view it. And I'm saying they in a very generic, I'd say a non-performer. People don't view it in the same kind of openness of willing to try. So
why do you think that is? Because they feel like it's so far separate. Because again, one of your challenges again is always to relate what you're doing back to their work, that rationale. And sometimes they might be going, why the hell am I being a tomorrow?
Well, exactly. It's kind of like, why am I doing this? What I don't understand why we're playing this exercise. It's got nothing to do with it. So I think it is comparing, well, how close is that exercise and why am I doing it? What's the relation to the business world and why am I doing that? But I think also a good example of the adaptation was when I'm doing my PhD, I did a study, I did a six session study about how to use improv to reduce public speaking anxiety. And I had a plan. I had a six session plan. This is how it's going to go. However, session one, people were a lot more anxious than I thought they would be. Or maybe my plan was too advanced or too, too advanced for those people who aren't as anxious. Because again, I had a room full of people with anxiety and fear about public speaking very different. I had someone who was very high and someone who was like medium. And while the medium person found it uncomfortable, the extremely high anxious person, too overwhelming, could not handle it. It brought kind of a real strong emotional response. And so in the moment, I had to go lesson plans out the window. I've got to bring it right back to a much lower anxious state and then build them up. because part of the a good part of this study was in the pretest. I made them all do an impromptu speech. I go, here's you got 3 minutes to prepare a 5 minute presentation on a subject. In the pretest, this individual lasted 5 seconds and they had a really bad emotional response.
Did they do 4 minutes of 55 seconds of silence? Were you like really mean?
They basically went, I can't, I've got to stop. And so that, you go, that's a very extreme case of someone who's very anxious. However, they wanted to get over it, and that's why they took part in the study. They did the 3 weeks, six sessions over 3 weeks. They attended each one, I think each one maybe bar one. They struggled throughout. They found it really kind of anxiety-provoking, overwhelming at times. However, at the post-test, they lasted 75 seconds versus the 5 seconds. That's around, what, a 1,300% increase in essentially in less than 12 hours of work.
Yeah.
And for me, that is an amazing thing to see someone who couldn't handle that could at least last for a minute. And that shows that if we did it again, they might be able to last for 2 minutes or 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And it shows the potential of how this improv, and actually it shows their journey. I'm so proud of them for actually they were willing to confront it, because some people dropped out of the study because they're like, I can't, I'm too anxious, or I don't want to do it. But this person was willing to go through it. And it was such a joy to see them progress so much in such a short space of time. So that was a situation where I had a prep plan, but it had to change each week, because the first week where it happened, I then had to change it every single week because I had to adapt and change. And even when I did adapt and change it, another curveball would happen and it would be too overwhelming, or for other people, it would be too overwhelming. So while moving forwards, I always have a plan. I will always talk to the clients and I'll go, what are you looking for? What's the plan? Like if it's a group workshop or a one-to-one, what's your measure of success by the end of this training? Well, I want to become X, Y, Z. And a good example of a client was like, oh, we don't want any of those weird, like, mommy, me, mo, like things. And I was like, that's fine.
You were almost Freddie Mercury at Wembley at that point there.
Oh, well, I try. But it is, because some people go, we've heard these things, we've seen these things before, it doesn't work well in this business, making them do sort of exercises that are really unfamiliar to their world. And so I went, great, I'll take that on board. I'll take out the exercise I've thought about doing.
I'll redo the whole program.
I'll redo this. I'll play around with it. But also it's understanding that obviously they're paying and they go, well, what do you want? Yeah. What do you think is going to value? And go, actually, if by the end of it, the team becomes much more coherent at this, we'll go, great, that was an amazing workshop. And we did. I had a really great time. And it's really interesting how I don't think I've had a workshop where people haven't thrown themselves into all of the exercises. Because I've built it up slowly during the workshop, everyone, as much as it might be a little bit anxiety provoking or a bit like, oh, what is this? They'll all give it a go because they're all having fun. I think that's the really important thing. Yeah. If you have fun when you're training or have fun when you're sort of doing it, it's so much more enjoyable from both a coach and a trainee. And you get much more out of it. So you go, that was great, I'm going to remember it much more.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, isn't it? Like that, I think there's a, we'll go back to Sir Ken actually, like I think there's this obsession with like curriculum, session planning, lesson plan, lesson objectives, like what if the curriculum was the child? Like what if the curriculum was built up of, you know, questions in sport that the game of the future is going to ask us? Actually, I lost a piece of work recently. I do it at my kids' school. I do some stuff with the scholars. And I normally turn up and I'll be like, really, like, kids, what do you want to get out of today? What stuff would, you know, and we'll freestyle. I might have some ideas around, but I go, okay, well, which of these three things do you want to explore? But they've had a change of personnel and the person in charge said, I need a full schedule of what you're going to do for 2 hours. And I was like, well, I haven't met the kids ever. Yeah, but I need a schedule of what you... And I was like... Anyway, I chose not to do it. My sense actually is, as you were talking there, made me think a lot about, like, I think I'll take it into coaching world and then you can translate it back to your world. I think we're getting much better at creating better sessions for players. So creating more playful learning experiences. I think we're getting pretty good at improv at a team level, at a sessional level, where I think we really struggle. And again, and I'm going to ask you a question in a second, is at improv at the individual level. So this person's at a different bus stop. And it immediately made me think about like the one thing, I can't remember if we chatted about it, but again, like you wouldn't want to put the really anxious person with someone who's not that anxious, because that gap suddenly looks really big. Right. You probably, you know, so there's tactics and stuff for you. But of course, all of this starts with like your noticing skills. So your ability to, I'm trying to go back to Seamus and go like, what was he so good at that means he was like, because I want to be like a brilliant improviser. I guess like noticing is the most important thing.
Yeah, so I think, I suppose, I'll try and answer the Seamus question. So I met Seamus around 10 years ago, because when I wanted to start this improv troupe, and someone suggested, oh, you should speak to Seamus. He's a great...
By the way, what's an improv troupe? Do you like...
So an improv troupe is, I suppose, in the basic terms, it's a group of improvisers. So there's five or six of us, and we'll put on a show regularly, like once a month, every other month, or we'll do corporate gigs. For example, a client might go, can we do a show for us? We'll go, great, we'll do a show. We'll do, and it'll be, you know, Whose Line Is It Anyway kind of style show. And so I met Seamus 10 years ago. I said, oh, I want some guidance on how to set this up and how to improvise. I'd never had any actual improvisation training until that point. And he said, come to some of my classes and learn. And what I learned from him, he's an amazing teacher because he's so fun. He's engaging. He's energetic. He is a short, ginger Irish guy. So it's the typical, like if you were to picture an Irish man, you'd be like, this is Seamus. He's a great friend, best friend even. And he's playful. He's a good listener. And also, because we've been improvising for so many years together, we know what the other person's thinking. So we've got that communion with the other actor, the other performer. And we've also
they talk loads about that in this. Like, that, it's such an, you know, we're getting better at it, aren't we? Like, trying to like understand what other people might be thinking.
And I think it also goes back to like, I know what he's thinking, or I know how we can be playful together, because I know his strengths. I know he's really great at physical comedy. He's amazing. He's a great mime. He's a great physical. He's physically a great performer. Intellectually, he's amazing in the sense of, you know, thinking outside the box, that adaptability, that creativity when you're thinking of ideas. And we work quite well because we bounce off each other quite well. And also, there's a very different size difference. I'm 6 foot, 6 foot five. He is, I don't know how tall he is actually, but there's a very great size. Less than 6 foot five, exactly, less. But there's a great physical difference. And often, so when we're teaching, or when he's sort of teaching his class, I will be kind of helping, and I'll sort of be the sort of partner that he will perform with. And it's just building that kind of connection, I think, is the really important thing. Like, I've noticed in my improv troupe, there are some performers that have come and gone over the years just because they've moved away, or they've come back, or they've gone to train, they've come back. And the ones I perform with the most, I'll have the best connection and the most, we'll be most playful together. I think that's the important thing with improv. It's how playful can you be, but also how accepting of the other person's ideas. Because when we get anxious and worried when we're improvising, we'll shut down someone's idea and go, no, like if we did a scene and I went, oh, it's raining today. And you went, no, it's not. The scene kind of dies. And I would say that's a block. But actually, as an improviser, even if you did that, I could still try and find ways of adapting. And I can incorporate that in the corporate world by going, your job is to say yes, but to everything I'm going to say. And my job is to say yes and to everything. So the yes affirms the world. So, for example, if I went, let's go for pizza, you might go, yeah, but I don't like pizza. And I can go, yes, I accept that you don't like pizza, and we can get a sushi instead. So already I've accepted, I've listened to you, I've accepted the world. And you might, yes, but I don't like fish. Yes, and we can have it vegetarian. Great. And it's a great exercise to demonstrate how you can solve problems in the world, because there's always going to be a yes, butter. There's always going to be someone who goes, yeah, but we can't afford it. Yes, and here's the discounted rate. Yes, but it's too time consuming. Yes, and I will take that time consuming load off you and do the work for you.
Hey, this is going to save my life with my kids.
But it is a great way to say, right, I'm going to say yes, and it's really important to get the yes in, because that means I'm listening to you. I'm not, if I go, I can't afford it. Yeah, you can afford it. I haven't listened to you. I haven't listened to anything you said. I go, yes, it's right, you can't afford it, and we can do this. So the yes is really important. And you can vocally say it to begin with, and then in your head go, yes, I've listened. Okay, I can't deny their world. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, but we haven't got the staff. Ah, yes, and it will only take one member of staff. There we go. I'm sort of solving the problem as we go. But going back to what you were saying about pairing people off with a really anxious person and a not so anxious person, sometimes there's pros and cons. The pro sometimes can be, if I see someone do it, I feel really good because I've seen someone master it. However, if it's a situation that I'm finding very anxiety provoking and you're not anxious, ironically, I'm going to feel more anxious because I'm like, they're not feeling anxious, but I should be. It's there's a great analogy. I read it in a book, and it's about, I think it might have been a paper actually. And it's about skydiving. If I go, I'm terrified of heights. I'd be absolutely terrified of going skydiving. If we were going skydiving together and you were so calm, I would feel even more worried because I'd be like, why aren't you terrified as well? Oh my God, should I not be? And then it's that kind of spiraling of things overwhelming you. So there is cause, and there's been studies of showing if you group people by emotional similarity, then actually it creates a buffering effect and they will be able to handle that situation together a lot more effectively. So if you have a lot of highly anxious performers, you know, athletes, group them together, and actually if it is a, you know, if it's the Premiership game or whatever it might be, and then train them together to help them kind of grow, might be a more effective way of doing it.
I passed out for the first 10 seconds when I skydived. That would be really helpful for you. Like, I've still got the video of it, of the first 10 seconds of me just like looking like I was dead. There's so much in that around like co-coaching, anticipating. Yeah. Maybe if we changed it from improv to anticipation, like again with players, like, how do I play with this player? How do the two of us like improv? How do we riff together? What strengths does this person do? What are they likely to be thinking now? What are they seeing? What am I, you know, how can we see the same picture?
I was going to say, it goes back to how well do you know who you're performing with? Like as an athlete, if I'm in a basketball team or a football team or a rugby team, do I know everyone well enough that I can kind of, I know the looks they give me, you know, in a social situation, go, right, that's the same look they give me when they go, give me the ball, or, you know, or pass it to me, or I've got your back. Because again, every time you might practice runs and drills and everything in sport, but you go, as soon as you get in that match, that goes out the window and you're improvising the whole match. There's no set plan. And you've got to improvise. So you go, actually, oh, player gets injured. We're now one member down, or our key player gets injured. How do we now formulate a plan? And how do we adapt in the moment? And that's where a coach and a manager can kind of help, going, right, we're going to put this person in, this is the plan, and they can help guide it. But even on the pitch, those players have to kind of work together. And if they don't work well as a team, then that's where you're going to do it. So you could relate it by going, well, how well do they work as a group? And if they don't, again, it's quite probably quite hard to determine this, but if they don't like each other, or they've been put together and they really hate that one player, it's going to go all over the place.
I'll finish with a story. There's a company called and rugby is, and sport is improv, isn't it? You don't know what your opponent's going to do, quite frankly, and even more complicated because in rugby there's 29 other people on the pitch. I guess what we end up trying to do is control, and like, we can't control the opponent. It's interesting how often, like, we, you know, we don't do improv. People do on a post training. Like, I think it's strange. There's a company called Game Line Analytics, and they do some stuff, TWI, Teamwork Index, and they look at, and a club I work with are doing, they're doing some work with them, and they've predicted every single one of their results this season before the game. They've looked at the team and they've gone this, and there's one that they haven't predicted right. And the reason they haven't predicted it is, so couple of injuries, two young halfbacks play together. Well, they didn't know that those two halfbacks had played together since they were 12. So they probably played like 300 games together. And like, so they predict a loss because these two have come in and there's not going to be like the ability to improv. And actually the reality is they've been improving together loads. And so they were fine. But it's so many parallels to sport as well. If people want to reach out and get in touch, like where's the best place?
So I think the best place, you can either go on the website, which is improv4 business.co.uk, or find me on LinkedIn, Alexander McWilliam. Just find me there. I think that's probably the best way to contact. I think that's probably the best way, really.
Well, I'm thinking about getting together a coaching group that does some improv stuff with you as well. So anyone who's on listening to the pod and is keen to do that, drop me a line. And I've just put it on my to-do list, which is already very extensive. So, Alex, it's been a pleasure, as I knew it would be. Loads of notes, loads of stuff that's helpful. Mate, have an amazing day, and we'll catch up soon.
Thank you very much for having me. Have a great day.